Hello, this is Ori Neer with Americans for Peace Now. We will soon start our conference with Yossi Alfer. Please hang on, and we will start it as soon as Yossi gets on the line.
Hello, this is Yossi Alfer.
Hi, Yossi. This is Ori in Washington. We can be heard now.
Hi,
how are you?
Okay.
We can be heard by other participants on the call, and we will start promptly at 2 o'clock, so, which is now. I suggest that we just wait just a couple of minutes to let people gather, and we will talk soon. We'll start soon.
Okay.
So for people who are joining us now, this is Ori Neer with Americans for Peace Now in Washington. We will soon start the conference call with Yossi Alfer. He's with us on the line already. We're just waiting just a little bit to let people gather, and we'll start in less than a minute. Hello, everyone. We're going to start. This is Ori Neer with Americans for Peace Now in Washington. I'd like to welcome you all to a conference call with Yossi Alfer. A few housekeeping matters. This call is being recorded. The recording will be available soon by request. Just email us, and we'll send you a link to the recording. You are all on mute at the moment. When we reach the point of Q&A, I will unmute you and give you directions of what you have to do in order to ask a question. Let me just tell you, I just came back from a meeting with Palestinian journalists who are visiting Washington. There were 5 people from the West Bank, 5 people from Gaza. Very interesting conversation with them about what it means to be pro-Israel, pro-peace, and to not see the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a zero-sum game at such time of war between Israel and Gaza. And what I told them, and I'd like to tell you as well before we start the conversation, is how we feel, how pained we are to see loss of life and pain on both sides for innocent civilians. When I talked to them about that, people around the table nodded. So I think the hope that the sentiment is mutual. A few words about Yossi. Most of you know him. He's the co-editor of the Bitter Lemons family of publications. He's an independent security analyst, formerly with Israel's Mossad. He was an official, senior official of the Mossad, former director of the Jaffe Center. You probably know him from Hard Questions, Tough Answers, which is a weekly analysis of strategic affairs, strategic and political affairs that he authors for us. And if you're familiar with the caveat of Hard Questions, Tough Answers, you know that he does not express APN's positions. His positions are his, hence the independent analyst. I'll ask Yossi to start with some comments framing the current state of affairs on the border between Israel and Gaza, and then we will open it to your questions. So, Yossi, thank you very much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Ori, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm speaking to you from Ramat HaSharon, just north of Tel Aviv, an area that is again under attack for the first time since 1991. The last few hours have brought approximately another million Israelis into the circle of objectives that are being fired at with rockets from the Gaza Strip. Let me give you a a quick snapshot of where we are now. The information is flowing extremely fast, and so what I'm going to tell you is correct as of about a quarter of an hour ago. A little bit of backdrop, a bit on the regional strategic aspects, and then my own bottom line, and then we'll open it to questions. In just over the last 24 hours since this operation began, 250 rockets have been fired into Israel, including one at Rishon LeZion, just south of Tel Aviv, and two at Tel Aviv. There have been over 100 interceptions by the Iron Dome anti-rocket missile system, very successful, very spectacular for those who are underneath them in places like Be'er Sheva. Only three Israelis killed in Kiryat Malachi today, and only because they simply didn't obey the civil defense orders and didn't even go into their stairwell, but apparently went out to their porch to try to see the rockets falling. But this is quite remarkable given the extent of the rocket fire. There are condemnations clearly from the Arab world, including from the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Thus far, there's no great criticism of Israel from the West, and there seems to be fairly firm support from President Obama. The Egyptian ambassador has been recalled, but that at this point is the extent of the active Arab response. Looking to tonight, the authorities expect a lot of rockets to fall on Israel. They expect heavy IDF attacks on rocket-firing sites in the Gaza Strip in urban areas. And the first day, the attacks were concentrated in open areas where there were very few civilians in the region, but there are many rocket sites and other Hamas and Islamic Jihad installations, laboratories, depots, and so forth. In the midst of the cities, the IDF has distributed leaflets telling people to take their distance from them. And I just was watching on television. There are a lot of explosions going on in Gaza as we speak. The IDF is preparing a ground operation. It is not carrying it out yet, but it's at least demonstrating that it's prepared to do so. 30,000 reserves have been called up. That's tonight. Tomorrow noon, Prime Minister of Egypt, Kandil, has announced he's visiting the Gaza Strip, which is unprecedented, the first Egyptian leader to visit Gaza, and in the midst of fighting, apparently with a large delegation, apparently to talk to Hamas about a ceasefire. That's the assumption in Israel, and to doing this because of American pressure and because this whole thing is embarrassing for Egypt, and I'll get to that very soon. Ismail Haniyeh, the prime minister in the Gaza Strip, made a TV appearance just an hour or so ago, playing it very tough. We can hang in there for as long as is necessary until victory. Some points of backdrop. The Israeli civil defense has improved immensely. The Iron Dome system is working. This is what accounts for the mere three deaths and relatively small number of casualties. Morale is high, and now that Tel Aviv is included in the targeting, along with all the bad in it, there's the good part is that there's a lot of national solidarity. This at least is good for deterrence. In other words, it's very important to show Hamas and Islamic Jihad, or for that matter Hezbollah in Lebanon, that Israelis are not panicking and are handling this and are going on with their lives. And Be'er Sheva, Tel Aviv, people are driving around, people are doing whatever they do on a Thursday evening. Hasbara, the public diplomacy, seems to be a bit more sophisticated and improved. But, of course, this is only good until the first major civilian casualties in Gaza. once the footage of those gets out, everybody understands that a good part of the world is going to turn against us. And I would say those kinds of casualties, civilian casualties in the Gaza Strip, are almost inevitable given where this operation is going tonight. It's important to note, if you listen to Defense Minister Barak, Israel's objectives in this operation are much more modest than they were in Operation Cast Lead almost exactly 4 years ago in the Gaza Strip. Then the leaflets that the Air Force distributed called on Gazans to overthrow, to join us in overthrowing Hamas, something which obviously didn't happen. Now the leaflets are simply calling on Gazans to take their distance from military installations, which are going to be bombed. The official objectives are improve our deterrence, the safety of the Israeli rear, attack terrorists in Gaza, and attack and eliminate rockets in Gaza. This operation was distinguished by a rather unusually successful surprise, the surprise attack of hitting the head of the military head of Hamas, Jabari, and of bombing the main depot of Fajr rockets and eliminating most of them. What we're being told is that those two that were fired near Tel Aviv are among the last in the possession of anybody in Gaza. After the Fajrs are Iranian-made rockets with a 70-kilometer range, meaning from the Gaza Strip they can hit anything south of Herzliya. Interesting to note the timing. While nobody, no official will acknowledge it, it's very hard not to believe that there is a link to the January 22nd election date. In other words, you couldn't postpone this too long because it would be too close to elections. This way, even if this goes on another week or two, there'll still be plenty of time for elections, and perhaps more important from the standpoint of Netanyahu and Barak, they're hoping to achieve a degree of peace and quiet between now and the elections and to take some credit from it. Now, that sounds very cynical, and nobody is saying that openly, but I'm just sharing that impression with you. I think the timing also, whether by design or not, it succeeds in embarrassing a Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, in Ramallah. He's on his way to the UN. On November 29th, he's going to ask for some sort of provisional statehood recognition. The state he's asking to be recognized is the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. He can perhaps aspire to control the West Bank and East Jerusalem. This operation makes it very clear he doesn't control the Gaza Strip in any way, and that it's really, even though he's expressing solidarity with Hamas, these are the guys, Hamas, who slaughtered dozens of Fatah activists when they took over in 2007 and have been ruling there ever since, and with whom the PLO in Ramallah has a long score to settle. Let me move to a few remarks on the regional strategic aspects. Hamas, until a few months ago, was not the one firing the rockets at Israel. 800 rockets have been fired in Israel at Israel in the past year. Until a few months ago, not by Hamas. They let Islamic Jihad and other jihadists and Salafists do it. Their pose was via Egypt, they'll arrange a ceasefire. In the last few months, Hamas has been firing the rockets. And I think it's fair to assume that what happened here is that when Hamas saw that Hamas is the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, and when it saw that the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood had taken over in Egypt, it felt enormously empowered by this. Now, Egyptians and Palestinians, including even if they're both from the Muslim Brotherhood, don't necessarily see eye to eye on a lot of things, but they are nevertheless much closer than, say, Egyptians and the PLO. So Hamas felt empowered, and they felt it with Egypt behind them, they could more safely provoke Israel with these attacks, and these provocations, of course, increased their popularity inside Gaza. Recently, and a few weeks ago, the Emir of Qatar visited Gaza, set up a diplomatic legation there, left behind $450 million. All of this has led Hamas to see itself as the vanguard of the rise of political Islam in the Arab world as a result of the Arab Spring. Let's not forget, Hamas won a democratic election in 2007. It can point to itself as the first party of political Islam that won such an election long before Ennahda in Tunisia and long before the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. It takes pride in this. It sees itself as a vanguard. It's getting backing from various places in the Arab world. Secondly, Egypt's very different role. In Mubarak's day, he would sit back and let us punish Hamas as much as we wanted and reluctantly perhaps intervene to mediate. But for Egypt, this is, again, this is fellow Muslim brothers. This is Gaza, over which President Morsi of Egypt has extended a kind of degree of Egyptian protection in his public statements. And in that sense, in many ways, what is being has been acted out in the last 24 hours and is going to be acted out tonight, tomorrow, and who knows how long, is in many ways a test, a first test of where the Muslim Brotherhood stands on the Israeli-Arab conflict. I say not just Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but Israeli-Arab conflict. It's a test from Hamas' standpoint. Will you stand behind us? Will you not allow the Israelis, for example, to invade the Gaza Strip? Will you threaten them? Will you cut relations? Will you cut military cooperation? From the Israeli standpoint, this is an extremely tricky operation because the question is, how much damage is this liable to do to our relationship with Egypt, which is absolutely key to peace and quiet on the Negev-Sinai border because of the presence of so many terrorists and Salafists in the Sinai and the need for Israeli-Egyptian military cooperation. So far, we've seen the recall of the Egyptian ambassador. Tomorrow, we're seeing an Egyptian, apparently Egyptian, attempt at mediation. This file is still open. Finally, let me just close my opening remarks with my own bottom line. Since 2007, when Hamas took over the Gaza Strip, Israel, and this is the Olmert government followed by the Netanyahu government, Israel has had no viable strategy for dealing with Gaza. It tried economic boycott to get back Gilad Shalit, to bring down Hamas. Total failure, counterproductive. It toyed with the idea of reoccupying the Strip and has avoided it, I think, very wisely, although there are some few people in Israel who do advocate it, and surprisingly, they're not necessarily from the right but from the left. But essentially, it's understood that through military means, you can only achieve limited objectives. It has rejected dialogue. It has gone along with the United States and the Quartet in setting conditions for talking to Hamas that Hamas refuses to meet. It's important to note that Hamas, in any case, refuses dialogue on its own, and for that matter, even the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is not prepared to dialogue with Israel. But this leaves it without a strategy. And so the objectives of this operation are no more than tactical. The most, I think, that can be achieved is a few months of peace and quiet before we revisit this entire scenario again, unless something changes radically for better or for worse, in relations not between Israel and Gaza so much as between Israel and Egypt. Let me rest my case there and be happy to hear your questions and comments.
Thank you very much, Yossi. One quick question from me before I open the floor for questions from the participants. Just one quick word, if you can, about Syria and Hezbollah. Is there a danger of this spreading to the northern border, considering the skirmishes that Israel had with Syria in the past few days? And is there a danger that Hezbollah will decide to join the hostilities?
Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, gave a speech about an hour ago in which he obviously expressed his support for Hamas, and offered to somehow be a supplier of ordnance, of arms, although how he's going to get them to Gaza under these circumstances, we don't know. But he went no farther than that. And let's recall that while Hamas does have some Iranian money and Iranian weapons, Hamas in the last year has taken its distance from the Iran-Syria-Hezbollah alliance. And as the Muslim Brotherhood succeeded in so many Arab countries, it has moved back into that sphere. So Hamas is in the Egyptian sphere today, not in the Iranian or Syrian sphere. In that sense, it's while there's going to be some lip service of solidarity, I don't think we're likely to see much more than that. Now, there have been a few instances in the last week or so of the Syrian army firing at rebels in a village right on the Golan border, with some of the shells falling in Israel. Today, a soldier was hurt by a bullet fired from somebody in Syria that went astray across the border. None of this appears to be intentional and directed at Israel. Israel, in one instance, did respond by destroying a Syrian army gun emplacement. And the Syrians responded by signaling us via the UN. We get the message, and they actually removed their military emplacements and just let the rebels hold on to those villages. Yesterday at noon, the chief of staff, Gantz, Barak and Netanyahu actually visited the Golan front as part of the deception to lull Hamas into thinking that Israel wasn't planning to attack, a successful deception. So in that sense, what's going on in Syria was actually helpful in planning this operation. Now, none of this is to say that we couldn't wake up tomorrow to some sort of flare-up on our border with Syria and or with Lebanon, but that was more likely to be some kind of spillover of the fighting in Syria and not a display of solidarity with Hamas. That's my impression.
Got it. Thanks, Yossi. I'm going to unmute participants now so they can ask questions. So you will be heard, so therefore I ask people to try to keep background noises to a very minimum. And once I give you the note, you can go ahead and ask questions. So just bear with me for a second. Okay, so everyone can be heard, and people should just go ahead and introduce themselves and ask them.
Ori,
so we have the first. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name is Marvin Supor, and I wanted sort of a follow-up question. At the beginning, you had mentioned that this fighting is an embarrassment to Egypt, and A, I would like you to elaborate on why that's an embarrassment, and secondly, why this might not be seen as an opportunity for Morsi and the Brotherhood to go all out in terms of distancing itself even further from Israel and moving more strongly into the rejectionist camp.
Thank you.
Okay. Ori, I'm taking these one by one, right?
Yes, but let me do this. I'll ask people if they may, if you're not intending on asking a question right now, to press *6. That will mute you, so we won't hear too many of those noises. Then you can press *6 again, unmute yourself, and ask a question. So wait for a second for people to press *6 and mute themselves, and then you can go ahead and answer the question. You'll see. Yes.
Okay. Why is this embarrassing to Egypt? The Muslim Brotherhood is still galvanizing and formulating its political rule and its political status. Egypt is locked right now in a very bitter debate over what the constitution will look like, with the questions of religion and state very much at the center. So this is a sensitive time in that sense. Secondly, Egypt is in dire economic straits because its tourist industry has collapsed, its gas export industry has collapsed, and Morsi is trying to recruit about $10 billion in loans from international institutions, the European Union, and the United States. People like President Obama, who spoke to him yesterday, are making it very clear: if you want us to help you, you're going to have to play a responsible role in the region. The perpetrators here are Hamas. They started all this. They are close to you. You're going to have to bring them under control and put a stop to this. If you want to come here and get money and get funds and get respectability and so on and so forth. And this is the only direction Morsi's gotten some money from the Qataris and the Saudis, but he needs the West. And Egypt needs the West. And so this is embarrassing in the sense that he can't go begging for money with this kind of fighting going on. Now, is this an up? I didn't intend to indicate that he's trying to move into the rejectionist camp. We don't know where he's moving. And we don't know what's going to happen next in Egypt, here in Israel, in policy planning circles. There is certainly a worst-case scenario in which relations with Egypt continue to deteriorate. As it is, the government itself doesn't talk to us, but the army does, and the army's talking. The army cooperates really quite well in the past 6 months or a year with regard to Gaza, and sometimes with regard to with regard to Sinai, and sometimes with regard to Gaza as well. Morsi has only recalled his ambassador so far. Terrorists from Gaza killed Egyptian soldiers in Sinai. Morsi took advantage of the opportunity in order to purge the army of its entire senior echelon and bring to the fore younger officers whom he felt he could trust more, and he wouldn't present the possibility of some sort of coup. Here he has another opportunity. Which way is he going to go? Is he going to exploit this to move into a more extreme Islamist camp, or to show that like his predecessors, is a responsible leader when it comes to maintaining peace and quiet on the Arab-Israel front? We don't know. It'll be very interesting to watch how he behaves in the days ahead. There can be little doubt that when it comes to the Muslim Brotherhood itself in Egypt, which Morsi, in effect, heads, they don't want anything to do with Israel. They want to cancel or radically reduce the scope of the peace agreement with Israel. They want to move the Egyptian army back into Sinai. They can never bring themselves to recognize Israel's legitimacy. But Morsi is now the president of Egypt and not just a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he has to listen to advice from more moderate and more centrist elements as well. And where all this is going to end, we don't know. But this is also by way of repeating what I said earlier. In many ways, what this drama is really about at the regional level is not Israel and Gaza so much as it is Egypt.
Thank you, Yossi. The way we have it set now is that people who want to ask a question should punch *6 to unmute themselves and then go ahead and ask the question. So please do that.
Yossi, this is Frank Bamberger.
Hi, this
can
is Susie Rosenbluth.
Yeah, let's start with Bamberger and then the next caller. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay. Yossi, could you please tell us how you see the role in the last couple months, particularly of Ahmed Jabari, who apparently was the first target of the Israeli assassinations in the Hamas area. There are some who see him as being supportive or furthering the development of a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. And there are some even who talk about his being Israel's surrogate. Is there any basis to any of this? Could this have been an Israeli mistake to assassinate him?
Frank, there are certainly some elements in Israel who have had informal contacts with Hamas, who were led to believe, indeed, that Jabari had become a factor for moderation. And they were very critical of his assassination. I don't pretend to have any to know what went on in Jabari's mind. It's clear that he was not involved in any direct negotiations with the Netanyahu government with regard to a ceasefire. Whatever he was doing was indirect and via primarily Egyptian intermediaries. It's rather natural that if there was an Egyptian attempt to restore a ceasefire, and there was in recent months repeatedly, that it was Jabari that the Egyptian army would talk to, because he was the guy who could presumably deliver on a ceasefire if such was decided upon. At the same time, let's bear in mind that in recent months it was Hamas and Jabari who were pushing the buttons and firing the rockets. They no longer even tried to hide behind the Islamic Jihad. So in the best case, Jabari was playing a double game. And this is a guy who has a long history of violence, by the way, not only against Israelis, but he was the one who led the attack on Fatah in June 2007 when Hamas took over the Gaza Strip and killed dozens of Fatah activists. This was Jabari, too. I can assure you that Fatah spokesmen who are shedding public tears over Jabari are in private not at all mourning the guy. My sense is that he was a fair target. And, of course, one can argue that that the whole idea of target assassinations is wrong, is taboo, and then it doesn't matter if it's Jabari or someone else. It is important to note that if in the past Israel, let's say in Sharon's day, targeted Hamas political leaders like Sheikh Yassin, this was a military leader, which at least has, I would say, a slightly higher degree of legitimacy. So I know some of the people who are making this argument about Jabari. Frankly, I think this is more an effort by Hamas by Jabari himself in recent months to portray himself as a vital figure who can deliver on a ceasefire, but who was playing a very dangerous double game and ended up paying for it.
Thanks. Helps.
Let's see. There was a woman's voice.
Hi, this is Susie Rosenbluth. My question is, what is it that you would suggest that Israel do now? Are you in agreement with Israel's proposal that what they're trying to do is even gain a few months of quiet, or do you suggest something else?
Well, look, if you take as your point of departure yesterday, and you see that Hamas has been firing rockets persistently at Israelis. It has been launching attacks across the fence at vehicles on the Israeli side and at army emplacements on the Israeli side. It has been aggressive and provocative in recent days. If you take that as your point of departure, you recognize that at least until a few hours ago, 1 million Israelis in the south, now it's 2 million, but before this began, 1 million in the south were spending a lot of time in shelters and bunkers, mm-hmm. that kids didn't go to school, traumas.
Right.
You have to recognize that no political leadership can suffer this situation for very long without being seen to respond in force. So you can support this operation insofar as it's designed to restore some tranquility and some deterrence. But I go back to what I said in my closing, the closing part of my opening remarks. What particularly perturbs me is that a guy like Ehud Barak, who is a strategic thinker, is not thinking strategically as to what our strategic goals vis-a-vis Hamas in Gaza should be. Do we want these guys to stay there? Do we want them to disappear? Do we have any means of making either one of these things happen? How do we factor this into the broader Egypt situation? This entire operation is tactical and temporary in nature, and mm-hmm. despite all the lofty talk that we hear from the politicians and the military leaders, we're going to teach them a lesson, we're going to restore deterrence for the long term, it ain't going to happen. This will be good for a few months at best. So what I would like to see beyond this kind of operation is some deeper strategic thinking. It leads me to recognize that we have to begin thinking really outside the box about whether it's possible to talk to Hamas. Now, as I said earlier, Hamas doesn't want to talk to us. In fact, no self-respecting Islamist is prepared to talk to Israel.
Right.
But it's possible that the advent of a Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt, which has to talk to us in one form or another, could be an opening to get to somehow communicating better with Hamas. And it seems to me that before we throw up our hands and say all we can do is every few months batter them so badly that they sit quietly for a while, it seems to me that before we say that, we and having exhausted all the other strategies and not wishing by any means to go back and reoccupy Gaza, we have to begin thinking about talking to Hamas, or trying at least. We haven't tried. The government of Israel refuses to even try to talk to Hamas, regardless of what Hamas has to say.
Egypt can be a positive factor here. Is there any scenario under which you could see reoccupation of Gaza as something that there's just no choice but you have to do it?
I don't think so, but I have to tell you something rather strange. So far, that whole issue hasn't come up here. But 4 years ago, during Operation Cast Lead, when we had a serious ground incursion into urban areas in the Gaza Strip, the question came up, should we just keep going and reoccupy the place?
Mm-hmm.
This was at the time of the Olmert government, which was Kadima centrists. The only people advocating this in Israel that I know of were left-wing supporters of Labor. Barak of Labor was then Minister of Defense, who were petitioning Barak to do this. And why? They were saying we have to go in, depose Hamas, reinstate the PLO, Fatah, Abu Mazen, and then we can have a peace process, because then the PLO will be empowered by reestablishing its rule in Gaza. Well, I hear some laughter, but this was seriously broached. And while I found it ridiculous that it was broached by some serious people, and Barak apparently, and Olmert and Livni apparently found it ridiculous, you don't hear it now from the Likud. Now, if you're thinking in a Machiavellian sort of way, you would say, well, sure, the Likud doesn't want a peace process with the PLO, so why should they empower them and reinstate them in Gaza? Of course, if you brought Abu Mazen back to power in Gaza at the with the help of Israeli bayonets, it would really finish Abu Mazen and as a self-respecting Palestinian politician, but the people who advocated that didn't seem to care about that factor. But this does point to another issue, and that is to answer your question, at this point, I don't know if anybody in Israel is advocating that. I think with all of the justified criticism of our unilateral withdrawals from southern Lebanon in 2000 and the Gaza Strip in 2005, nobody misses those places. Nobody advocates it. You hear of no war scenarios in which Israel reoccupies any land populated by large numbers of Arabs. I think we've learned our lesson about occupation. We haven't applied it in the West Bank yet, but we've really learned it, especially when it comes to 1.6 or 1.7 million people and counting in the tiny Gaza Strip. But this does point to another issue. If you talk to Hamas, what do you do about the PLO, which is your peace partner and which claims to represent all Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank? How can you justify this to the PLO? How can you explain this to them? Now, we used to have that problem with Egypt as well, because Egypt under Mubarak was a supporter of the PLO. We wouldn't have it now, because Egypt under Morsi is a supporter of Hamas. But there are some heavy issues here as to how you balance any even attempt to talk to Hamas with your relationship with the PLO, which is grounded in the Oslo Accords and in our understandings with the United States and the Quartet.
Yossi,
can I ask
you a question? Hello?
Einstein in Atlanta? Hello?
Yossi?
Yes.
What impact might this incident have on Netanyahu's thinking about Israel's response to Iran and its nuclear efforts?
I don't think it will have any, quite frankly. Beyond perhaps the question of, let me put it this way. The military lessons from our capacity, thus far quite successful, to intercept incoming rockets and at the level of the civil rear to maintain high morale and get through this bombardment, the military assessment of that will obviously be a factor in thinking about the possibility of some sort of military clash with Iran, in which Hamas probably would not join in, but certainly Hezbollah would. And Hezbollah would be firing in many ways the same rockets, although at a different part of Israel. But beyond that, I don't think it's very much of a factor, unless we'll wait and see, unless things get out of hand, particularly again between Israel and Egypt. As long as it's limited to Israel and Hamas, this is going to end. It's going to end in a ceasefire. If there's any clash with Iran, the IDF will have to take into account the possibility that Hamas could join in. It will certainly take into account Hezbollah. It will have learned some lessons from this. It will have improved some systems. But at the political level, at the level of international diplomacy that Obama is engaging now in trying to allay this scenario with sanctions and diplomacy, I don't think it's going to make any great difference.
Yossi, this is Ken Stein in Atlanta.
Go ahead, please. Sorry.
Yeah. First of all, hi, Yossi. Bear with me for a moment. Ken Stein in Atlanta?
Okay.
Ken Stein in Atlanta. Hi.
Okay, Ken. Hi.
So bear with me for a moment. If it's in Israel's interest, if Israel sees the West Bank as more strategic than Gaza, that is to say, it's much more important to have a stable West Bank vis-a-vis Jordan and vis-a-vis Israel's longest border, then any focus and concentration on Gaza is better for Israel over the long haul, particularly if Israelis aren't yet made up a decision of what they want to do with the West Bank and how much they'll withdraw, if at all. So any focus that you have on Gaza, including the Qatari visit, including Erdogan's potential visit, it seems to me that you emphasize Gaza and you then emphasize the West Bank, even if it only buys you time. Isn't that in Israel's strategic interest?
I don't think it's in Israel's strategic interest to turn its back on the West Bank or to de-emphasize it, because eventually something nasty is going to happen there as well. It doesn't have to be Hamas, but it's enough for the Palestinian Authority to collapse, or for Israel to help it collapse, which people like Avigdor Lieberman are threatening to do, in order to put the West Bank very much in the focus. Now, you know, it used to be easy to say the West Bank is strategically more important than the Gaza Strip. As matters stand today and in recent months, given the nature of rule, of Islamist rule and in Gaza and the inflow of all kinds of Salafis and jihadists from all over the Arab world via Sinai into the Gaza Strip, given the flow of arms, given the very problematic link of terrorism and smuggling between Gaza and Egyptian Sinai, and the Egyptian failure to come to terms with this, this is becoming an extremely important strategic nexus, if you like, of quadripartite relations, Israel, Egypt, Sinai, Gaza. In parallel, the West Bank is quiescent. That's very convenient for Israel. It's convenient for the Netanyahu government not to have to deal with it. It obviously deeply perturbs Abu Mazen, who's trying a variety of ways to attract attention and now is planning to go to the UN to do it. I think one important issue to emphasize here is that even if Abu Mazen will be able to command an automatic majority in the UN for this provisional recognition, in no way, shape, or form can he argue that he represents Gaza. There's absolutely no reconciliation process between the two, for that matter. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is not particularly interested in making this happen, and Hamas is feeling empowered and the wave of the future, and it's not making this wanting this to happen either. So Abu Mazen is painted into a corner.
Abu Mazen a transitional figure, no matter what?
I don't know. I really don't know.
I mean, he's going to die ultimately.
Let's remember that Abu Mazen, uniquely in the recent Palestinian leadership, is a man of peace and nonviolence. He's not someone who can easily reach an agreement with Israel. We saw this with Ehud Olmert. But Netanyahu has made absolutely no serious attempt to engage him. If he's a transitional figure, we're going to miss him. If he's not a transitional figure, we should be doing more to engage him, because if he can't maintain peace and quiet in the West Bank, and that's eventually what will happen, what's liable to happen in the West Bank, affecting, as you note, not just Israel, but Jordan, which is increasingly being destabilized by Islamists itself, all of this could make Gaza look like child's play and remind us very much of the strategic importance of the West Bank.
Hi there, this is Len Zutterman from L.A.
Can I have a question from Los Angeles?
Yes. We have callers from L.A., so let's start with the one who started just before you.
Gregory Lowe?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah, it seems to me, although I'm not sure of that, of course, that the best strategic way of dealing with Hamas is to isolate them and to make peace, to make a bigger effort to make peace with Abu Mazen, because that's the only way that you could put pressure on Hamas to stop whatever they want to do.
Thanks, Yossi. Let's ask the other caller from LA to ask his question as well.
My question is this: you've outlined a series of very significant policy strategic issues that need to be resolved. All the questions posed are all meaningful and important. One would expect the function of an electoral system to debate and resolve and set direction for the future. What prospect is there that Israel has the political capacity for a meaningful election to address and debate the issues you've outlined?
Okay, two very good questions from L.A.
Another question from L.A. Can I have?
Let me do one more thing.
Third one?
Before we call
okay.
from Washington.
Okay, L.A. 3.
We're approaching the end of our call. I want to add one more question, if you will, just for clarification. You talked about possibly talking to Hamas. You don't mean political peace negotiations with them. You mean something short of that, obviously. So maybe just a few words about what could be the content of such Israeli talks with Hamas, and how would the issue of the siege come in?
Okay. I'll take these one by one. The first question suggested, wouldn't it be best to isolate Hamas and make peace with Abu Mazen on the West Bank? Well, this is the Israeli official strategy of recent years. Certainly Olmert embraced it and tried very hard to make peace with Abu Mazen. Netanyahu rhetorically embraced it, but it didn't try to make peace with Abu Mazen, but it certainly continued up to a point to isolate Hamas, although after the Mavi Marmara incident in May 2010, Netanyahu felt obliged to relax the economic isolation of Hamas, and today there's not much left of that isolation given the relatively open border between Gaza and Egypt. So now the problem here is that suppose you do enter into serious negotiations with Abu Mazen, which I'm all in favor of, but he is going to insist on signing an agreement based on the West Bank and Gaza and some sort of land bridge between them, as well as East Jerusalem, when in fact he doesn't control Gaza and, frankly, he doesn't have a hope in hell of controlling Gaza in the foreseeable future. So there are a lot of problems involved here, which it's not just that Israel has to come to terms with them, but Abu Mazen does, the PLO does, Fatah does, and they're not coming to terms with them. They're simply pretending they don't exist, which is extremely problematic, because what we're looking at today, if we conceivably reach an agreement with Abu Mazen, what we would be a de facto, de jure, we'd be looking at a two-state solution, de facto a three-state solution, and we're in a three-state reality today. And again, at the strategic level, nobody's dealing with this. Not Israelis, not Palestinians, and not the international community. Now, will the Israeli elections address these issues? Well, so far, the Israeli elections have rather uniquely, in the annals of Israeli elections, focused not on issues of war and peace and strategy, but on social and economic issues. And we've seen smart politicians like Shelly Yechimovich, the new leader of Labor, who has expanded Labor's political reach significantly by basically, or Yair Lapid with his Yesh Atid movement, that by simply radically downplaying the Israeli-Palestinian and even the Israeli-Iranian issues and focusing on issues like education, a more equal distribution of wealth, and the like, and succeeding that way in pulling some support away from the Likud and the right wing. So unless this operation or something else radically changes the Israeli mindset, no, this issue will not be a major issue in these elections, particularly if the current operation succeeds to the extent of guaranteeing a fairly good degree of peace and quiet in southern Israel until January 22nd. Turning to the third question from L.A., what would you talk to Hamas about? Okay, Hamas doesn't want to talk about peace. Hamas, like all Islamists, Shiite and Sunni, cannot conceive of peace that legitimizes the existence of a Jewish state on what Muslims consider to be waqf, or Islamic endowment land. That is all of the land of Palestine, Eretz Israel. So they can't talk to you about this. They can talk to you about some sort of long-term ceasefire and coexistence. When you look at their conditions for talking about this, and they have, or not necessarily talking directly to us, but for agreeing about this, they also include outlandish demands like the return of 5 million Palestinian refugees to Israel. But we've never put this to the test. We've never sat down with them and said, okay, look, we understand we're going to be, particularly in the since the past year, we understand you, Hamas, represent a political Islam, which is gradually surrounding us. You're in Gaza, you're in Egypt, you're in southern Lebanon, you'll probably be in Syria, and God forbid, you may take over Jordan as well, and even the West Bank. We understand you're not going to sign peace agreements with us. If you're prepared to live at peace with us, let's see if you are prepared to offer reasonable conditions, let's say 67 lines, a Palestinian state. You're not going to recognize Israel. We won't recognize you. This won't be a formal peace treaty. Let's see if we can put into place the kinds of guarantees that will make it worth our while. And in fact, if we're talking to Hamas now, it's not about the West Bank. It's just about Israel and the Gaza Strip, where there's absolutely no border quarrel whatsoever. This is the most you can talk about. And in fact, if we could sit down with the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, we would, of course, have a different point of departure because there already is a peace agreement. But I would assume the discussion would also center on modes of coexistence that are acceptable to fundamentalist Islam that fall short of full-fledged state recognition and legitimization, but that can guarantee some sort of long-term coexistence. Is this my ideal of Israeli-Arab coexistence? Absolutely not. Certainly with Hamas, this is what we would have to consider if we're going to talk to them. And I take into account that these talks might very well fail, which leaves us really without a strategy other than containment, which is what we do today, at a price which some might find too high and some might agree is acceptable for us. This is not my ideal. But as we look around us today, Hamas is in some ways seen to be the vanguard of the Islamization of Arab politics all around us. And if indeed this is the case, we are unfortunately going to have to radically readjust our sights, but nevertheless continue to look for ways that we can coexist with our neighbors and that will allow them to coexist with us. This also means we have to maintain a high military readiness and a high deterrent profile for the foreseeable future.
This is Ed Brody from New York.
This will be our last question, Ed, so go ahead, make it short, please.
How do you expect the Palestinian people, whether in the West Bank or in Gaza, to negotiate with Israel, which is constantly taking over their land, denying them their rights to live in peace, which is what you want for yourselves, in Gaza, by blockading the entire country, shooting at people that come close to their border, sending in bulldozers and tanks, and then complaining when these people have exercised their rights to fire against these military incursions? You took over Gaza, and you pat yourselves on the back for unilaterally pulling out. You should never have been in Gaza. The people in Gaza, you've already driven off their land in Palestine and made internal refugees of them. You continue to
thank
do
you for
that.
Your question. Go ahead, Yossi.
Okay, I get the gist. I'm the first one to recognize that in 1967, the best thing we could have done after occupying the Gaza Strip and the West Bank in a legitimate war of self-defense, the best thing we could have done was to pull out and let people there fend for themselves and at all costs avoid occupation. I fully accept that the settlements were a Barbara Tuchman-esque example of folly and continue to be as they expand and grow today in the West Bank. Having said all that, I can't accept this blanket condemnation that everything is Israel's to blame for everything and the Palestinians for nothing. Let me remind you that in 2005, under Ariel Sharon, of all people, we withdrew from the Gaza Strip, lock, stock, and barrel, settlers, army, everybody. When confronted by the question of Philadelphia Strip, the border between Gaza and Sinai, Sharon went farther than the most far-flung Israeli doves of the Geneva Accords and said Israel will have absolutely no control over what goes on there. Let the, of all people, the European Union, generally considered to be toothless, come in and monitor the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. He didn't even ask Egypt whether they agreed to this, by the way. And we pulled out. And a huge international effort was made to help the PLO taking over Gaza to engage in
their own.
And they failed. And they failed miserably. And they ended up firing rockets at us, even though there was no territorial quarrel whatsoever. This was the most important Palestinian endeavor at state building. It failed completely. It so embarrassed the PLO that they ended up being kicked out of there by Hamas. I don't have to tell you who Hamas. I hope I don't have to tell you who Hamas is, and what they want for Israel, Israelis, and Jews. As I said, I'm all for trying to talk to them, although I kind of doubt they'll be prepared to talk to us, although we certainly should try so we can tell our children and grandchildren that we tried. As for the West Bank...
I think there's a rather different interpretation of what you've just described as our pullout.
I know there is. I'm giving you mine. I'm an Israeli adult.
We're really running out of time.
I supported the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. I know plenty of Palestinians who thought then that we had to be more generous in withdrawing and today would agree with what I'm saying, just as I know plenty of Palestinians who today agree that Yasser Arafat was a thug and a terrorist and an out-and-out liar whom you could never make an agreement with. Just walk around Ramallah and ask people today what they think after a few years have gone by. Having said all that, I'm prepared to remove all the settlements and make any deal possible with Abu Mazen, not because he's done such a splendid job, and not because he is even prepared to really come to terms with the existence of a Jewish state in the heartland of the Middle East, but because the occupation is destroying us from within. And we have to save ourselves, even if it means we're going to live with rockets falling on us, which is exactly
the time for
today.
Is there time for a question? No, we don't have any more time for questions,
but I have an idea because I know that there are many people with questions still. How about if people email me their questions and I will forward them to Yossi, who will try to incorporate them into his next Q&A, which we will publish next Monday. So my email address is onir@peacenow.org. Again, onir@peacenow.org. Email your questions to me. I will forward them to Yossi, and he will make an effort to address them in his next Q&A. I have a feeling that our next Q&A will also be devoted to what is going on in Gaza. I'd like to ask... Yossi, thank you very, very much for joining us. I want to thank everyone else for being on the call as well. A recording of this call, as I said before, will be available. Email me, and I will... send you the link to the recording. Again, thank you for joining APN for this briefing call. We'll have more probably in the next few days on the situation in Israel and Gaza. This concludes our talk. Yossi, thanks again, and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.